Hello, everybody. This is Oscar Dahl. I'm here with Matthew Knutson, and this is We Like Movies. Matt, this day is finally here. Star Wars, The Last Jedi.
I'm fired up. I got a lot of notes, a lot of things I want to cover. I kind of feel like Jake Gyllenhaal in Zodiac, you know, when he like went to the Hall of Records or whatever, and they wouldn't let him bring a pen. They said, you can read whatever you want, but you can't write anything down. And so then he immediately like ran straight to the coffee shop so we could write all of his notes down as quickly as possible. I'm afraid if I don't get these out, I have them written in front of me here, but I feel like if I don't talk about them soon, they're not going to be nearly as potent.
Have you not had the chance to discuss this movie with anyone yet?
Not really. I've been sequestered at home all weekend working. It's very cold outside. I'm under the weather. Mm-hmm. And so, no, I saw it on Thursday night, and I haven't really talked to anybody in the last couple of days. I've just been writing essays and stuff all weekend. So cool. I texted with our mutual friend Ryan Julio a little bit, and he had some provocative things to say about this. But no, you're pretty much the first person that I've really discussed this. My mom wanted to hear about it, and I sort of gave her my quick and dirty thoughts. But no, this is the first real conversation I've had about this. But I've been, you know, obviously reading and listening to podcasts all weekend, so a lot of different opinions swirling around in my head right now.
Yeah, this is exciting. There's a lot to talk about. We're going to just do a quick, real quick 5 minutes on The Shape of Water, which is Oscar contender Guillermo del Toro, and then we'll get directly into Last Jedi. So
yeah, this is no disrespect to Mr. del Toro and his beautiful film, obviously, but yeah, there's clearly a priority to this episode.
Shape of Water, his best film since Pan's Labyrinth, I think it's safe to say, right?
Certainly.
And a really good, beautiful, sort of moving fairy tale. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Got even a little dusty in the theater a couple times. Sally Hawkins is fantastic, and it's going to go down as one of the all-time great movie creatures. What else you got, Matt?
I felt exactly the same about it as I did about Pan's Labyrinth, where I felt like this is very impressive. This is very handsome. This is very accomplished. There's clearly, you know, somebody with an incredible vision at work here. Mm-hmm. But I just don't think I'm really a del Toro guy. I don't mean to necessarily reduce him down to saying you need to be on board or off board. But he just really has never made a film that I was able to just completely get emotionally swept away by. Like, I appreciate it. I appreciate this movie a lot. I appreciate Pan's Labyrinth a lot. I appreciate The Devil's Backbone a lot. I was impressed by certain aspects of Crimson Peak. I was impressed by certain aspects of Pacific Rim. I've liked things he's done in the past, and I like this. I just am not swept away by it the way that a lot of people are. And I'm trying to figure out exactly why that is. It's just, he's just speaking
the
language.
You're just an emotionless, robotic, unfeeling person, Matt.
I'm as susceptible to schmaltz as much as the next guy. Like, I'm a hopeless romantic for sure. It's just, I don't know, something about his insistence on really, really going hardcore with some of the body horror and some of the gore, I think that has a tendency to turn me off a little bit. Like, I like the fact that he is making fairy tales for adults. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that he's really leaning into the sexual stuff, only if for no other reason than he's like not shying away from the fact that that's going to be an important part of this relationship. You know, how could it not be? So, you know, he's not making monster movies for a wide-on. He's making monster movies for adults, which is cool. It's admirable. It's niche, but it's cool. But just, you know, like some of the, you know, by the time Michael Shannon's gangrenous fingers have to come, you know, like, because I knew exactly where this was going. Like, as soon as he got those fingers reattached, I'm like, I know exactly where del Toro's brain is going to go with this. And, you know, there's stuff like that all over Pan's Labyrinth, too, where it's just like, oh, I just don't know if this is necessary. It's just a little bit of a turnoff. And as a result, I just kind of always feel like a little bit removed from the experience. Like, again, very impressed, but always kind of like stepped a little bit back and being like, all right, you know, I can appreciate that. Don't know if I ever need to necessarily see that again, but I'm glad that it exists.
I'm probably a little higher on this movie than you are. I thought it was pretty darn great. There is something odd about this being like a fairy tale with symbolism. However, it's also extremely visceral, both, you know, sexually and with gore and violence. But, you know, I thought a lot of the characters were great. I love all the actors, of course. I mean, Richard Jenkins and Michael Shannon and Stuhlbarg and Sally Hawkins and Octavia Spencer, of course. Great, great ensemble. But it's a movie I don't anticipate revisiting, and it's, you know, maybe we'll sneak into my top 10 list. Maybe we'll talk about it more in the sort of award season stuff we have coming up. But shall we move on to Star Wars?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say to wrap it up, Sally Hawkins. If I had to give the Best Actress Oscar to somebody right now, gun to my head, it would absolutely be Sally Hawkins. With all due respect to Frances McDormand and Saoirse Ronan, and I'm sure Meryl as well. I haven't seen the post yet. This is definitely hands down, I think, the finest female performance of the year. Like, it's not just the gimmick of being mute. She just does things. You know, there's a physicality about her in this movie, and there's just an emotional approach to this character that I just have never seen anything like it. So everything you've heard is true when it comes to Miss Hawkins. Her entire career has been leading up to this performance, I think.
All right, moving on. We got to give the people what they want, Matt, and that's Last Jedi talk.
Yeah, and I think we're going to give half the people what they want and half the people what they don't want. We'll see. I'm not going to give away which half is going to be happy and which half isn't, but I have a feeling this might be a little bit of a divisive conversation.
We haven't talked about our feelings about this movie yet, so I don't know where you stand. I mean, this is going to be a spoiler-filled podcast, of course.
100%.
And this movie's interesting. Rotten Tomatoes, critics, 94%. The audience score is very low at 53%. However, the Rotten Tomatoes audience score and like the cinema score, so general audiences, seem to like it quite a bit. But the people who are willing to vote on Rotten Tomatoes, which is sizable, it's like 100,000, last time I looked, 100,000 votes, have this at like a middling 52%.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's very important and very telling about how this thing seems to be. 3 days into this thing, we're already split down the middle. Although, like you said, pretty much unanimously loved by critics. So, I mean, I think on Metacritic, which sometimes is a little bit of a better indication, it's still high 80s, right?
Yeah, it's like 86 or something.
But again, audience score still, right, 50%-ish, less than 60 for sure.
Well, so the audience score, I think the Rotten Tomatoes audience is much more fanboyish and like movie buffs than sort of the general audience. Like I said, the cinema score, which I think is just random people coming out of the theater. And, this might be the only movie they see all year. They might see every Star Wars movie. Who knows what their thing is. But they seem to like it as opposed to the fanboy internet people.
So that would lead us to believe that the kind of person who would be sort of like angry walking out of this movie or disappointed would be the kind of person who would go straight home and immediately start doing something about it, right?
Yes.
Sounding off and voting and making sure their voice is heard that it fell below their expectations. What were the circumstances of your... We've both just seen it once now, right?
Yes, I've seen it once. I'm excited to see it again. I saw the 7 p.m. Friday show at Cinerama. Packed house, ravenous crowd. Great times.
Lots of people in costume?
Obviously the Thursday night show was the most cosplayed of it. But there were a couple dozen people in costume for sure.
Saw a lot of Jedis, but the thing I saw most of was Rey's. Saw a lot of women dressed up as Rey. She does have a super cool costume, but
kind of an easy costume.
Yeah, I said, but go out and get yourself some ace bandages and stuff to wrap up your arms, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, I appreciate the fact that, 24 months after that character was first introduced, we already got a whole lot of Rays in attendance. People were going nuts. I mean, everybody, there was a lot of, murmuring, tittering, people were starting to clap before as the Lucasfilm insignias came up. I mean, of course, as soon as the big title popped up, people burst into applause. People were laughing. People were screaming. People were just, just hanging on every... anything that even came close to fan service, people were just ravenous about it. It was a very, very involved crowd that I saw it with.
All right, Matt, let's stop dicking around here. just give me some general thoughts. Expectations met or not?
Just rip the Band-Aid off. Yeah, I was pretty disappointed, to be perfectly honest. I've been doing a lot of soul searching over the last couple of days, trying to figure out what I missed and what is wrong with me. Then as I started to sort of see the tides changing a little bit online and see that there was a little bit of dissent, all of a sudden I started to feel like I wasn't quite so lonely anymore, that maybe I'm not alone in this. I basically sat there for about 2.5 hours and was making this noise through most of it. And that pretty much was my disposition throughout the entire thing. Not angry, not turned off, not necessarily dismissive, just sort of surprised at some of the storytelling decisions that were being made on Mr. Johnson's part. And mm-hmm. I would say I enjoyed the experience. I would say there were potentially some series highlights, certainly a lot more humor than I expected. But on the whole, to me, it felt like a pretty bloated, problematic narrative. Like most of my issues had to do with narrative clunkiness and bloat, and just a lot of threads that I felt were unnecessary or at the very least not particularly satisfying in the direction that they went.
I'm going to preface my thoughts by saying I think this movie will age a lot better than people maybe anticipate. I've heard people even go the other way, say the initial sort of visceral reactions to this movie are going to be more positive, and then it'll get nitpicked to death as we go forward. I think it's actually going to be the opposite. I think years down the line, people are going to look back at this as a really important turning point in this franchise, and they will see this as a very good movie. That said, I loved it. I need to see it again. There's a lot going on in this movie, and Rian Johnson's choices are so far, veering to the left when you're expecting it to go right almost at every point. I think it's just a little bit jarring to sort of wrap your head around what's going on here. Reading everything I can, just trying to settle my thoughts here, I'm enjoying it more and more. Part of that might be just sort of an innate contrarianism to these fanboys. I'm sort of just drinking in their tears a little bit. I'm enjoying that aspect of it.
Well, let me contextualize my sort of stance here a little bit in saying that I don't really consider myself I'm not trying to sort of qualify here. But I certainly, I think I've made it clear on this podcast that when it comes to sort of fanboy culture, I'm much more of a, Indiana Jones, James Bondy kind of guy than I am a Marvel, Star Wars guy. Doesn't make me better, doesn't make me worse, doesn't make me a hero. It's just as much as I have enjoyed Star Wars and consider myself, relatively educated in the ways of the series, I don't dress up. I don't, I wasn't one of the people who used to like sit in line for days, sit on the sidewalk for days at a time to get tickets. Mm-hmm. I feel I've been burned enough over the years that my feelings about the series have been somewhat tempered. So I think it's kind of interesting that I'm going to end up being sort of like rolled in with these fanboys who feel that they've been wronged. And how interesting is it that like that is going to be the chorus of dissent here? Of these guys that maybe it's actually going to be the people who maybe went into this thing not knowing very much about the series, not caring very much about the series, or a lot of people, maybe this is even their introduction to it. Mm-hmm. It sounds like maybe those are the kind of people who are really high on it. Although that being said, tons of critics are really high on it as well, and I'd be shocked if a professional movie critic wasn't relatively educated about this franchise.
Yeah, they're educated, but they don't have the time to just rewatch these movies, at length, like sort of the fanboys do. They've probably seen them once or twice a piece, right? Like if you're a movie critic, you're just watching new movies all the time.
Yeah, although nowadays, dude, we're getting to the point where some of our major critics are grown-up fanboys,
That's true.
All the blogs that are out there, all the online journalism, and some of our I guarantee some of the critics you and I probably read the most are not that much older than we are. So we're kind of contemporaries now at this point.
Let's start here, and then I think this will provide a sort of gateway to talk about the films, just the film in general. You mentioned you had narrative issues, and that's where sort of everything starts with you. Let's go through that. Like, what are your narrative issues with this movie? Is it story choices, or is it pacing, or is it? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, it's a little column A, a little column B. I'll start just going through my bullet points here. And again, if you missed our earlier spoiler warning, this entire conversation is going to be spoilers because that's how we do things here. We like movies.
Yeah.
Basically, you're picking up almost exactly where The Force Awakens left off, right? Quantum of Solace style, if you will.
Yeah.
And so the entire movie is like, a chase on one side of the galaxy, the slowest chase ever, by the way. Mm-hmm. And then, kind of some sort of Jedi training on the other side of the galaxy. And neither of those things seemed particularly exciting to me. The whole Jedi training situation was kind of a non-starter, which I understand was intentional, but it still made it difficult for me to get particularly involved in it. The other one is this slow boat chase where there is this very shoehorned motivation to get a couple of our heroes off the ship to send them off on this goose chase that ultimately leads to absolutely nothing. Like, yeah. I feel like you can take this whole Vegas planet, you can take that entire, you know, 25 minutes worth of screen time in a movie that's 2 hours and 35 minutes long and completely lose it, or at the very least, truncate it significantly. You got a lot of bullshit going on that planet that makes very little difference in the overall scheme of things. You got a lot of proselytizing, this sort of like anti-capitalist proselytizing. Not that I disagree with the sort of political message of it all, but I'm not sure if I necessarily need that shoehorned in when there's a whole lot of other things to worry about in this situation. And then you have one of the what I would consider one of the biggest missed opportunities in the casting of a supporting character in a Star Wars movie, in Benicio del Toro's DJ is his character's name, who has a stutter for no other reason than Benicio del Toro can't play characters that don't have some sort of weird affectation or tic, right? That's just in his contract. He just literally won't show up for work unless you let him force a tic into each performance. I thought he was an absolute waste of time, and I was kind of turned off by what a waste of time he was and how much time the movie spent sort of like bending over backwards to justify him being there. That whole section of the film sort of comprised the part where I really tuned out the most and started wondering what the point of all this was.
Okay, I think parts of that are fair. I mean, I like seeing other planets in this universe. I think that's a fun, just general thing. Part of the issue with Force Awakens is that they killed like an entire planet, and you didn't really understand what that planet was and who they were and how this old rebellion thing works, right?
Yeah.
And so giving us a glimpse of the, you know, the war machine and the fascism that is the First Order and why people sort of are okay with it, I think was important. Additionally, like, I liked how this whole quest was for naught and was bullshit anyway, because this is a movie, by and large, about failure, right?
Yeah, which is something of a callback to The Empire Strikes Back, an intentional one, obviously.
And so I didn't mind that at all, because it was the plan sort of made sense in this, you know, Poe Dameron machismo sort of way, right? Gave Finn and his new pal something to do, and obviously that's not like a good reason to do anything in a movie, just because we have actors waiting around waiting to do something. I didn't mind that too much. I think if we look at it sort of a larger sense, like narratively, especially looking at past Star Wars movies, the narratives are always pretty simple and they always happen in a pretty quick timeline, right? I mean, I'm not counting the prequels, but like original trilogy, like everything happens at once, like in a really condensed time. It's like not like these movies take place over weeks or years ever.
I'm not necessarily pushing back against that. I actually would have preferred this to be a little more simplified. Okay. I thought we were complicating matters unnecessarily by sending them off on this thing, and sort of like the way that they conceive the plan and the fact that they do this really clunky cutscene with Lupita Nyong'o. You know, that they basically see like some sort of video game cutscene of her, I don't know, fighting, or, you know, she's on the other side of the galaxy, and she gives them this really like flimsy motivation for how they can find this codebreaker character. Plus, he's a space hacker. Come on, guys.
They didn't actually say space hacker.
The codebreaker, whatever they want to call him.
Codebreaker,
like,
come on.
That really smacks of like Rian Johnson shows he shows up hungover one morning to the script meeting or whatever. He's just like, we need something. I don't know. He's a code breaker. Whatever. We'll figure it out later. We'll smooth it out later. And then cut to, you know, now we got a shooting script and we never fix this problem.
But isn't the whole thing like this is a Hail Mary and this is just a half-baked plan in general? Like that's the point of it, right? Is that like it's a failed bullshit plan and it's half-baked from the beginning?
But like give me something, man. You know, there's like some specific, a little something besides literally a placeholder motivation for why we need this guy.
If in the end it came to fruition and he did help them out with his code breaking skills, then I would care about that, right? But the fact that, again, this was a Hail Mary half baked thing to begin with, And like a mutinous sort of plan in general, where they should have trusted their, you know, their leaders here or whatever.
Yeah.
I didn't mind that at all. However, I will agree that entire subplot is the weak point of the movie.
Yeah, it's a lot of shoe leather and it's a lot of screen time. And basically what we get out of it is, like you said, we get Finn and his new pal sort of getting to spend some quality time together, which leads to, I think, sort of a forced romantic potential, which I also wasn't really buying. But I guess if you really needed to send them off on that just so that you could justify the fact that there might be feelings starting to blossom there, I still don't think it necessarily justifies it, but I buy that much more than I buy sort of the impetus for the mission. And then,
well, I'm guessing the romance will have more weight in episode 9 because it means that, you know, Rey lost her, you know, chance with Finn or something like that, right? Or Finn's moved on from her, and that will give her maybe motivation to do something. We'll see.
Yeah, I appreciate the building of the love triangle. I'm just not totally on board with this Rose Tico character, because it's one of these tough situations where we're being introduced to a new character and expected to get extraordinarily emotionally involved with them very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And there's this really clunky scene at the beginning where you see her sister sacrifice herself, and they spend all this time lingering over this little medallion, and you know, you obviously are getting the point that they're lingering so much on this medallion that there is going to be some sort of like weight to wherever the other side of that medallion is. And I don't know, to me it just felt like kind of clunky storytelling. Hey, audience, we need you to feel like you've known this character for a long time, because we're going to start throwing a lot of shit at you that requires this character to resonate. So it felt to me like they weren't actually doing any of the legwork to get there. Whereas I felt like in The Force Awakens, JJ was doing very, very elegant, very economical, but very effective things in terms of getting us up to speed with all these new cats as quickly as possible. Here, I felt like they weren't really disciplined in necessarily getting us on board with these new characters, particularly Rose, who I felt was underserved by this particular script.
Interesting. I didn't mind the character. I thought that initial, you know, the first scene with her sister was, I don't know, I felt endeared to her. But again, if they had eliminated this part of the movie, that would be 25 minutes of screen time we'd have back. But it really is is the C story, right? Like there's far less of it than I think we're making it out to be, right?
Yeah. So then we should discuss the flip side of that particular coin, which would be what Poe's up to in the ship, right? And he and Laura Dern having this power struggle. And I also wasn't really buying much of that, to be perfectly honest. And there's this weird rope-a-dope thing that they're doing where they got to teach Poe a lesson, which I guess is she and Leia taking this guy down a peg because he's too headstrong and he's getting people killed. I don't know. It felt like, you know, can't we teach him a lesson once we sort of get out of this pickle? Like, we'll have plenty of time once we get to the next base or whatever to teach this cocksure young kid what he's doing wrong. For the time being, can't we just survive instead of taking the time to like fuck with him? Why didn't they just tell him that they had a plan and that there was a planet down there they were on their way to, and that, like, don't worry, buddy, like, we've got this handled?
I think it made sense. I mean, this guy is, he's a hot dog, he's a loose cannon. They put up with him because he's the most talented pilot in the galaxy. But, you know, if they tell him anything, he's gonna fight back, and he's gonna tell everyone. I mean, maybe they need some secrecy to follow their plan. They rope-a-dope me. I like that idea because it's such a cliche trope to have this guy be right. You know, this sort of rebellious, mutinous, headstrong dude. Like, he needs to succeed to save everyone. Whereas the sort of more level, conservative path is actually the right one, and that rarely sort of happens in movies. And so I got rope-a-doped a little bit, and I enjoyed Laura Dern's work, especially how it all played out in the end.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a situation where we've just been introduced to her, and then we're kind of expected to be extraordinarily emotionally invested when she does this kamikaze thing, right?
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason the movie gets away with it is it's such a awe-inspiring visual. Right?
Yes.
Like people in the theater, you know, gasp when we see this thing go to the light speed or whatever and crash through this. So that's impressive, but it's kind of like, okay, I literally just met this person three scenes ago. I just can't quite get myself there. You know, like, they barely bat an eye when Admiral Akbar dies in this thing, right? We've been with that guy for at least three films.
Okay,
come
so...
Come on, who cries for Admiral Akbar?
He's got no personality. He's just a big space fish. Like, there's nothing...
Space squid, please.
Space squid, whatever. Like, he's got no... like, the only reason people care about Admiral Akbar is pure nostalgia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he has no backstory. He has no emotional resonance just besides being a squid.
No, I was only half kidding. I guess what I'm saying here is that I just can't get myself there with this Laura Dern character who I met 20 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. You know, and I feel like the movie's really, really leaning into the fact that she's made this enormous sacrifice. And if that was the case, why don't we just get everybody off the ship earlier and, you know, set the thing, you know, put the thing on autopilot or something and send it through.
Yep.
Put it on a timer. Say, all right, send yourself to warp speed in 35 seconds. We'll all get off the ship. I found my wheels turning a lot more during this thing than I wanted them to. I felt like I was kind of like seeing behind the curtain a lot. I wanted to get swept away, and I rarely did the way that I feel like Force Awakens had me the entire time.
Force Awakens had some real bad sort of like narrative leaps that we all had to go with, right?
Yeah, it's weird. I've been trying to put my finger on it for the last couple of days, and I can't because I watched it again a couple of days ago and had the exact same experience with it. And you know how skeptical I went into that movie. Like, I was not really on board with this whole sequel trilogy idea, you know. I was very, very skeptical before we started off on this thing, and then The Force Awakens completely sold me. And then I was very disappointed by Rogue One, and I've been equally disappointed by this, and now I'm kind of back in stick-in-the-mud mode again.
Yeah, so here's my theory, is that Force Awakens was just nostalgia porn, right? It was, you know, South Park, the member berries thing. It's like, remember this, remember this? And it went the way you would expect a Star Wars movie to go, right? It was smooth sailing, less, you know, structurally, just everything was like a callback to the original film and the original trilogy. When you're smooth sailing like that, you do feel things. Nostalgia is a powerful drug. You're more susceptible, you know, to the emotions in the film, and you're more willing to sort of let different narrative things go. But what I think this movie has done, and I think you're part of this, you know, fanboy group. I'm not calling you fanboy, but you have the same feelings here.
Because
this movie doesn't go where you think it's going to go, because this movie is so wildly different narratively than any other Star Wars film, that's when you start, you know, nitpicking a little bit. I'm just not too worried about these narrative things and the idea that these characters aren't fully developed. I mean, Star Wars films are littered with sort of throwaway characters, but we accept them because they're from our past, right?
I mean, everything you're saying makes logical sense. I just don't. Maybe I'm giving myself too much credit here or just being naive, but I don't think that I am susceptible to those kind of things you're talking about. Like, I really am not somebody who drinks the member berry Kool-Aid, you know? Like,
yeah.
I'm not crazy about Stranger Things, and, you know, I had my issues with it, and I certainly didn't, you know, like, never felt that pang of just like, oh, I love this because it's reminding me so much of a new hope necessarily. I just happen to like JJ's storytelling style. I just think he's a good filmmaker, and I think he's a good writer, and he gets a lot of shit, but I like his sense of rhythm, and I like his sense of trajectory, and I like his sense of kind of like forward momentum, and I like how economical and devoid of fat his films almost always are. I've liked all of his movies. I liked Super 8. And I even liked Star Trek Into Darkness. So maybe I'm drinking the JJ Kool-Aid, not necessarily the fanboy Kool-Aid. But I'll tell you what, I got, you know, choked up and butterflies in the stomach and goosebumps on top of goosebumps many times while watching Force Awakens, and still do. Whereas I never once experienced any of those things while watching The Last Jedi, as much as I wanted to, and as much as I like Rian Johnson. I love Rian Johnson's filmography. I even liked The Brothers Bloom, and I loved everything he did on Breaking Bad. So I'm on board with the guy. To me, this just felt like a departure for him in the wrong direction.
Again, like I'm a big JJ fan too, and I really like Force Awakens. But that movie was steeped in nostalgia and was meant to sort of, you know, just repave the road for Star Wars and just be like A New Hope and get everyone, suck everyone back in so we could start again new. And the reason, you know, I suspect you felt those pangs of nostalgia and you got, you know, teary-eyed or whatever during Force Awakens was because all these people have been, you know, codified in your brain because these movies have existed in your past for forever, right?
Yeah, but most of those experiences were with characters I had just met, you know, like seeing Rey get the, you know, when she gets the lightsaber for the first time when they're out in the woods, you know, I just met this character, you know, 75 minutes ago, and I'm already completely invested in her, and I care about her, and now I care about this fight with this other villain who I also just met 75 minutes ago. As much as I think Harrison Ford's really great and really cute in that movie, mm-hmm. and as fun as it is to sort of like see some callbacks and stuff, those aren't my favorite parts of the film. My favorite parts of The Force Awakens are what's going on with the new characters and what's being, you know, what's happening on these in these new environments and these new creatures and stuff.
Well, we'll get to Rey and Kylo Ren soon, but I still think they're the best parts of this movie.
I would completely agree. Yeah, I agree.
But I just want to go back and say, you know, like in terms of Laura Dern's character, right? And I've seen these complaints from the fanboys on Reddit and elsewhere, the people who are upset with this movie. That, like, you know, Snoke doesn't have a good backstory. Laura Dern doesn't have a good backstory. But if you go back to the original fucking trilogy, like, there are so many characters that are just there and have a major sort of they serve the plot in a major way. You know, Grand Moff Tarkin or even fucking Billy Dee, right? Like, Lando is not that deep of a character. I mean, he sort of gets away with it and is able to imbue some stuff with his just charisma, I suppose. But there are a lot of these, like, authority figures and these generals and whatever who are just kind of boring and are there to serve a plot purpose. So we're not putting them under the magnifying glass. And so I feel like all these people, you know, Benicio here, Laura Dern here, like, we don't need those characters to be sort of super deep.
Well, you watch your mouth about Lando Calrissian, sir. Billy Dee's a national treasure.
I know, but like, how much of his backstory do we get? Again, that's like really good Lawrence Kasdan writing to give some, you know, a very brief points of exposition within dialogue between, you know, Harrison Ford and Leia and Lando himself, but.
I can't believe we're living in a world in which we're talking about getting a Boba Fett spinoff film, but nobody once brought up getting a Lando Calrissian. I mean, I understand he's going to show up in the Han Solo movie, but like, why didn't he get his own spinoff movie?
Well, he might yet. You know, yeah. Depends on how good Don Glover is. I would watch that movie for sure. I understand those plot. And well, I guess for you, they're not nitpicks. They're sort of deal breakers, it seems.
I'm definitely going to come off as the hard one on this in this conversation for sure, because ultimately I was disappointed, but I certainly enjoyed the experience, and I'm glad that people are really into it, and I do appreciate how many departures Johnson had the balls and the freedom to sort of explore, because that is exciting that he was sort of like willing to burn some of this stuff down. Like, literally, there's a pivotal scene in the movie where Yoda shows up and literally burns the history down, right? It's very intentional. It's one of the best scenes in the film. It's really exciting, actually.
Just in a very general sense, you know, Force Awakens was good, but it was such a narrative rehash of A New Hope in so many ways. We couldn't go on like that. So, like, Rian Johnson, we you know, everyone's saying, like, oh, kudos to him for tearing it down. Like, he had to fucking tear it down. Like, there's no other option unless we're just going to have just blatant nostalgia porn the whole time. And it's weird. Like, people, even up to release, were expecting sort of a literal rehash of Empire Strikes Back, like almost beat by beat. You know, I've been paying attention, like, the different subreddits for Star Wars. I guess I feel like people are still not cool with that. And it's weird to sort of finally understand and get it crystallized that people really just wanted something nostalgic, right? And are really acting aghast at the fact that this movie didn't play out exactly like they had expected it to. I think Luke's a good example. Maybe we can start talking about this. But the idea that people wanted Luke to be this infallible person and this, like, this godlike person is crazy, and it seems to be like that's the big issue for a lot of people, is the way they treated his character.
I personally was fine with all of that. I thought his trajectory is fine. I would have preferred for there to be a little more meat on the bone of his relationship with Rey. I felt like for as much time as they spent together, as much time as he spent on that goddamn island, I never felt like they really got that moment of connection that I wanted or was expecting. But in terms of like him,
but isn't that kind of the point of this movie though?
I guess, if that's intentional, then yeah, mission accomplished. I guess I don't know. It's strange. I was in a class the other day at this very eloquent professor teaching this class called interactive narrative, history of interactive narrative, and he said a really interesting thing which really resonated for me. He said, you know, fanboys, fan culture, whatever you want to call it, they don't know what they want. They know what they like, right? Mm-hmm. So we need people like Rian Johnson to show up and give us something new and to give us something to chew on, because most of us know what works for us and we know what we enjoy, but it doesn't necessarily mean we know what, for, you know, something like the Justice League is a perfect example. Justice League or DC in general is just being way too conscious about, like, every time a new movie comes out and there's negative response, they pivot or they try to course correct and they overcompensate, like sort of like listening to the jungle drums, or they're not sort of doing their own thing or finding their own way.
Yes.
It's a really, really dangerous way to go about making art, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I do appreciate the fact that Rian Johnson is trying something bold here. The thing is, I don't necessarily agree with you that what we want or what we think we want is just rehash or just something that sort of like strokes our nostalgia response necessarily. Call me a naive altruist about this, but I personally don't believe that's what I'm looking for. But I don't think this direction or a lot of the decisions that were made here are necessarily what I was looking for. It doesn't necessarily mean he should be making the movie for me or any of these dissenters.
Yeah.
But this movie didn't scratch my itch the way that I guess I hoped that it would.
Yeah, I am really interested to watch this movie again, maybe a couple more times. I'm interested for you to watch it again. Just because, again, like, it's a lot to take in.
Yeah, it's dense. It's very dense.
It's a very dense movie. There's a lot going on. Like I said, I think this movie will actually age better than even the naysayers think it will. I mean, this is a movie about tearing down institutions, and it's tearing down institution while doing that, right? I think the Luke Ray stuff is really important here. You know, Luke is not this infallible master. He didn't train her very well. Like, I was looking at Joseph Campbell's, like, hero journey today.
Of course you were. In.
Yeah. And he really...
You're such a pro.
It's crazy to look at this because he had only, you know, Luke had only really gone through the first two-thirds of the hero's journey in the original trilogy. And it's almost beat by beat the third act of the so-called hero's journey that Luke goes through in this movie. Like, I guarantee that is something that Rian Johnson was looking at, right? Like, there's literally, like, the second-to-last thing in the 17-step hero's journey, which I wasn't terribly familiar with, but the second-to-last step is literally called Master of Two Worlds, right? And, you know, he... and Luke is obviously in two different places at once, and then the next step is sort of freedom to live, a.k.a. ascension, right? And that's exactly what happens to him. I find it interesting that he's completing the hero's journey like almost beat by beat while being a sort of disappointing mentor to our new hero.
Yeah, now that is interesting that he has to that he, in a way he almost can't be a mentor to someone else until he actually, you know, completes his own journey or whatever, right?
And I suspect he will be a mentor in the next film.
Showing up in it, yeah. Here's an interesting little piece of trivia. Mm-hmm. Alec Guinness was 63 years old when he showed up in the first Star Wars film. Mark yep. Hamill was 64 when they started shooting this. Here are the clues suggesting that Luke is never actually on the planet of Crait. He has shorter, darker hair and has a shorter, darker hairstyle and beard that matches his appearance in the flashback scenes. It is established that there is no way in or out of the base. A character even asks Luke how he got in. When he confronts Kylo Ren, he uses his original blue lightsaber that once belonged to his father instead of the green one he uses in the flashbacks. Furthermore, it is the same blue lightsaber that was destroyed in Snoke's throne room. Finally, mm-hmm. Luke's X-Wing is shown to be underwater on Octo, and it is implied that he has no way off the planet. Also, and I didn't notice this the first time I saw it, I'll have to look closer the next time, every time he steps in the salt planet, he doesn't leave red footprints.
Yeah.
So that's
great stuff.
That's kind of fun, yeah. That's a little attention to detail.
And so I think this leads to the crux of this movie, and and where I think this movie shines brightest, which is the Kylo Ren and Rey storyline, right?
Yeah.
No matter what you think of any other point in this movie, I think we've given birth to one of the great movie villains slash characters ever in Kylo Ren. This guy's and Adam Driver is a big part of that, right?
Yeah, I was on board. Go back and listen to our episode from 2 years ago, people, because I was on board.
Do it.
Yeah, I was on board with Adam Driver and Kylo Ren from the beginning because I liked the idea of a petulant, you know, emo Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. Who obviously, you know, who was cosplaying and who was angry at his dad. And I don't know, I was on board with that from the beginning because it was something new, something distinct. And I think they've paid it off really nicely here. I think he's great. And I love all the you know, communication across force time or whatever you want to call it. It's very, I don't know, it sort of follows this force logic we're already aware of and comfortable with. But
yeah.
It kind of visualizes it in a new and interesting way.
It does, and I just appreciate his motivations or his, you know, him struggling with his motivations or what he actually wants, right? You know, the idea that he is also trying to tear down an institution, and he wants to, you know, he's not just one-track-minded, wants to rule the galaxy or whatever. He wants to do it in his own way, and he's willing to sort of bring on a member of someone from, you know, the light side of the Force or whatever. He's struggling internally. We don't usually get that from our movie villains, and even Rey's journey going back and forth. I mean, the whole Snoke throne room scene fight, and then the sort of aftermath of it, I thought was incredibly well done.
It's pretty strong, yeah. And visually, in that just that the red room. I have it in my notes here as one of my one of the positives. It's on the positive side for sure. Crazy Twin Peaks red room with the crazy red samurai guards or whatever.
And the other, maybe one of the most exciting things about this movie for me was the reveal of Rey's parentage, right?
Yeah.
And that has really pissed off a lot of people. And, you know, it's Rey's parentage. It's the fact that Snoke was just a random bad guy. I love the fact that they didn't play up the fan service to, like, connect all the dots and make sure everyone was, you know, has whatever heritage they had assumed, right? Like, this is me drinking in the fanboys' tears again. Like, there's been so much digital ink spilled, you know, speculating who she was and where she came from, that Rian Johnson absolutely made the right decision here by having her just be a nobody.
Yeah, I'm 100% on board. I completely agree. I mean, yeah, what are the odds that she would just happen to be a Skywalker or a Kenobi or whatever? Like, I really like the idea that she's just a rando. That was the right choice.
So yeah, I think all that stuff was really good. I, you know, the movie is so long that when they got down to the crate plant, you're like, holy shit, we have another act here. Like, is that happening?
Yeah. And I don't want to be a negative Nancy again, but the planet looks so amazing, and just the design of it is so incredible, just the environment, that the actual, what is the plan exactly? Like, is the plan to just get in these old cruisers and just fly towards the walkers and just hope for the best? I mean, it literally seems like they have absolutely no plan, no guns. I mean, we're already at the point where we have very few rebels left. We're really just going to, like, is this a suicide mission? And then, of course, Finn turns it into a suicide mission, and that suicide mission seems like it actually might be useful, right? Like, oh, yeah, if he flies this thing directly into that weapon, that might actually be helpful. Yeah, do that, actually. I hate to lose Finn, but that might actually work. And then, of course, she stops him at the last minute.
Yeah.
And I was like, God, there was no plan until all of a sudden Finn had a pretty good idea, and then she stopped him from it. It's like,
but Matt, why Jesus do they have Christ. To have a- I mean, this goes back to the whole, you know, casino planet, all that shit. Like, why do they have to have a good plan? Like, these are, like, they're almost hopeless, right? Like, they're pulling out Hail Mary after Hail Mary because that's their only choice, right?
Yeah, but literally, I mean, they can't compete in terms of firepower, right? Like, how is this not a suicide mission? If you want to call it a suicide, if you want to say, all right, guys, let's go out in a blaze of glory, that's kind of interesting, but it seemed like they actually wanted to go out and fight, like they had a chance. It seemed like the only justification for that was how badass it was going to look when all their ships strafed along all that salt and left those red trails. It literally seemed like an aesthetic decision there.
Well, I think there's a point where, like, you know, the First Order had tracked them, and that wasn't like a inevitability, right? They were hoping that they would not realize that they had all gone to this planet.
No, I don't mean going down to the planet. I get why they would want to go to the planet. I think going to the planet was a good point. Once they get to the planet and the walkers show up or whatever, I can't think of a worse, quote-unquote, plan than just flying as fast as you can towards these things you can't compete with and hoping for the best. That made zero sense to me, except for the fact that it looked really, really cool. and if that's the reason, I suppose I can get on board with that. If it's an aesthetic decision, this is going to look boss. All right. I'm in,
what other choice do they have? Just wait to get destroyed, right?
Well, then eventually they figured out how they could fall back and retreat, right? Mm-hmm. So why not just immediately start retreating the minute that you see that you've been beat? You know that there's superior firepower on this planet coming after you.
Well, they needed a couple things to happen. They need Rey to sort of distract them.
They need the Millennium Falcon
and Luke to distract them.
Well, they needed somebody to come and pick them up. But why not at least run in the opposite direction as opposed to flying in the complete wrong direction into the path of the fire? I don't know.
Well, because they thought that they could take down that beam or whatever, right? That was going to knock down the
wall. Yeah. So all right. So we once again. People gave J.J. a lot of shit for his Starkiller base, and yet we still found a way to shoehorn in yet another Death Star into this thing.
What?
It's like they literally have boiled it down to just its essence, right? They literally have just taken the weapon out of the Death Star and dropped it on the planet.
That's not a Death Star. That's not a planet-killing weapon.
They say it. They literally, somebody, it's a line of dialogue. He says, it's like a mini Death Star. He's like, it's like a mobile Death Star or something like somebody literally drops the Death Star name.
I don't remember that line.
I swear to God, it's there.
I'm going to assume that it wasn't there. You were just hearing it. In your mind.
I swear, somebody says it's basically a mobile Death Star.
Okay.
Of course it is. But of course, all that is forgivable because it sets up this incredible standoff when Luke finally shows up, right? Which is very, very satisfying and very fun and very fan servicey and is a beautiful send off for his character for sure.
I agree with that.
Have we ever seen this kind of astral projection force power before in any of the films or Clone Wars or I don't remember anybody ever transcending this way before. But then again, if anybody was powerful enough to do it, of course it's going to be the penultimate Jedi, right?
Yeah.
For a second there, I was just like, huh. I didn't know that was a thing, but. For all, of all the things that bumped me out of this movie, that wasn't one of them. I kind of felt the same way when I saw Leia, float back to the ship after she'd been blasted out. I was like, oh, I guess I sort of knew that she had Force powers, but the Force can, I don't know, it felt like Harrison Ford in Force Awakens. Like, that's not how the Force works.
I mean, this is.
I'm just digging myself deeper hole here, aren't I?
I've really enjoyed reading all these complaints on Reddit. I've loved it because this is all made up shit anyway. This is all nonsense to begin with.
I get it. So, I'm just saying, if the movie makes me start to think these things, I gotta blame the movie a little bit on that, right? Like, I'm supposed to be swept away by these things and distracted by other things, as opposed to sort of scrutinizing and nitpicking.
Is the same idea that if it was just rehashing everything we'd already previously seen, then you wouldn't have an issue with it. But the introduction of new ideas or new things is putting people off is kind of silly to me, and puts the franchise in a bad spot if you're not allowed to introduce new ideas or just new things we haven't seen. Yeah, and Space Leia, I guess, is kind of silly, but. I don't know. It makes sense to me. I didn't mind that at all, and it's been fun reading how vitriolic people are about the idea of Leia, moving back 20 yards into the spaceship or whatever.
I don't have a problem with it philosophically. I thought it was a little silly in the way that it was visualized, but
Do you have any issues with the character of Snoke? That's also been a major point for these people.
No, I never cared about him to begin with. I don't really care that we killed him. I don't know. I really don't have any thoughts one way or the other about Snoke particularly.
Yeah, the world's always been full of just random shitty bad guys, right? Just power hungry emperors or whatever.
Just in terms of the whole the Luke thing, think about how easy it would have been just as a throwaway line or something when they were in the. Temple, or when they were talking about the books or looking at the, I mean, very easily he could have just cracked open a book and been like, there once was a Jedi from Nantucket, you know, who was able to astral project, like just some throwaway thing that, you know, we didn't know whether or not would come back, just something really, really casual, just to tee me up a little tiny bit. Again, this is a very minor nit that I'm picking, but in an environment like this, it would have been so easy to just squeeze in one little piece of throwaway exposition just to tee that up.
Yeah, I think that would have, I don't know, maybe laid it out a little too much if we would have assumed Luke was a projection, and it would have ruined the moment. But I don't know. We've seen these Force ghosts forever. I mean, this is not that much different than that.
Yeah, it's not. It's not a. No, it's not a bridge too far. It just seems like they. I mean, they were spending plenty of time. You know, with the exposition of this film, that would have just been one more line that they could have thrown away somewhere.
What'd you think of Yoda?
I thought he was wonderful. Exciting to see a puppet come back. I mean, that's the kind of fan service that definitely really worked for me.
Yeah, but I mean, that did seem, that felt like the Yoda we knew from Empire Strikes Back, not the shitty General Yoda from the prequels, right?
Well, that was the plan, right? I mean, that's why they did it. They obviously did it physically, and I heard that they went and found the mold for the Yoda that they used for Return of the Jedi, and then when they molded the new Yoda out of that, he looked too sad and too old. So they actually reconstructed his face to give him like smiling cheeks. so they made him a happier Yoda. They made him a smiling Yoda, so he'd be a little more jovial and mischievous, I guess, as opposed to old and dying. Lovely little speech he gives. He says something to the effect of "There's no greater teacher than failure," which I thought was pretty profound. And yeah, that whole sequence with him burning the temple down and stuff, I thought that was all great. I thought that was all fun. That was a highlight for sure. Sort of on the same token, on the same planet at least, how about the groovy little hall of mirrors she goes down into at one point?
Yeah.
That's pretty wacky, right?
Yeah, it was pretty sweet. I know you felt maybe that it was a little lacking in terms of the training or whatever. Again, I think that was kind of the point. But I enjoyed everything on Octo, that, you know, the island planet, and I thought Mark Hamill was just fantastic throughout the movie.
Yeah, no, he was great. I mean, I was sort of hoping that this would be a sort of a meaty enough situation, and he would be able to really prove himself to us in a way he hadn't before, and maybe give himself an opportunity for a little awards love or whatever, at least maybe a Golden Globe situation. But unfortunately, it just came out too late, and I just don't know if there's like that one big monologue-y scene or whatever to push him over the edge. And it's, and of course, it's a very stacked supporting actor year as well.
Oh, well. Yeah, and, you know, I think he's overshadowed, like everyone in this movie, by Adam Driver, who I think gives another amazing performance in the movie.
Is there a sexual component to that, now that we know that they're not related, now that we know that they're not cousins or whatever, there's clearly like some sort of forbidden fruit star-crossed situation going on between the two of them, right? Especially now that we've sort of given Finn his love interest as well. Like, there's clearly going to be a sexual component to that relation, or seduction component in the next film between the two of them, right?
I mean, I think that was the point of his shirtless scene, okay, right?
to me, that felt like an in-joke for the girls, for fans of girls, actually.
Yeah.
But I it was cute. That is a perfectly good segue to talk a little bit about Johnson's approach to humor here, which I think has also been a little bit controversial. I mean, the movie basically begins with a crank call joke.
Yeah.
Which is cute until it's not, because it goes on for way too long. But I also think it's definitely one of those moments of just like, oh, you know, you if you're not on board with this, this movie might be a slog for you. Mm-hmm. And that may have been my first clue. It was when I started to bristle a little bit at that.
I enjoyed all the goofy humor. Again, this is all made up dumb shit anyway. Like, the whole point of this is to have fun, and get a little escapism. Not taking anything too seriously in this movie, I think, is right. Being realistic or dwelling on, you know, I just go back to the fact that, like, a billion people were murdered in the last movie. Right, this is a space opera. This is a space fairy tale. We should have fun. It never took me out of the movie. I loved like Luke milking that thing. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, that was pretty disturbing.
So no, to answer your question, I didn't have any issues with any of the humor. I thought it was actually sort of a breath of fresh air.
Luke tossing the lightsaber as soon as she gives it to him. That was kind of cute. Because it completely deflates the last scene of the last movie.
I do wonder what J.J. Abrams feels watching this movie.
Yeah. Or if he had any input about any of this stuff.
Yeah, if he had
he's a producer.
J.J. left a lot of threads open that Rian Johnson immediately just tossed aside, you know? Yeah. Snoke was probably made to be like the big bad guy in the trilogy, and obviously you just killed him right away. And
see, I have a hard time believing that they don't have some of, you know, I mean, I gotta imagine Kathleen Kennedy or even Lawrence Kasdan, I mean, they're having meetings about this stuff, right? It's not like they're just saying, you know, handing Rian Johnson a typewriter saying, go with God, see you in 6 months, you know.
I think they did.
I have a hard time. I mean, when she's canning directors left and right who aren't, you know, towing the company line. Mm-hmm. You literally think he's making these kinds of decisions in a vacuum by himself without having to vet some of this stuff?
Well, I will say this. J.J. Abrams is notorious for not having a plan once he's done with whatever he's working on at that point, right? He likes to keep a lot. I mean, Lost is the prime example here where, you know, everyone thought there was some sort of grand master plan, but there very clearly wasn't. Same thing happened on Alias, right? And so I don't think J.J. Abrams was concerned or even thought about where these things would go. He was just, you know, trying to make a movie and leave things open for whoever's taking on next. It will be interesting to see where J.J. Abrams now takes it.
Because he can retcon some of this stuff if he wants to, right?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
It can be a big fuck you to, you know, like he resurrects. I mean, yeah, why couldn't Snoke come back now as some sort of Sith ghost or whatever, right?
I guess
the Jedi's have been doing it for years. Why can't the bad guys do it too?
Well, I mean, Rian Johnson didn't make it easy for JJ here. There's no obvious way that Episode 9 is going to go, right? Do you have any feeling walking out of the theater like, oh, I know what the next movie is going to be?
Not in the least, and I think that's a sign of success on Rian Johnson's part.
Yeah,
he's clearly set us up for.
Yeah,
we really could go in a bunch of different directions, which is awesome.
It's hard. Like, it's not apples to apples comparing this to the original trilogy because the first trilogy was a little bit more streamlined in terms of narrative arc. He sort of knew exactly after Empire how things would have to kind of go. Right, you'd have to save Han, and then you'd have to take down the Empire. And now the Empire is sort of, or the First Order's, a little bit in flux, and I guess the idea is that Rey will somehow take down Kylo Ren. There will be some sort of face-off again. But besides that, I don't really know where it's going
to
go.
I don't know. I was about to say she doesn't turn him the way that Darth Vader, you know, got turned in the final analysis. But then again, he kind of sacrificed himself at the last minute, and I feel like to do that again, to have Kylo Ren do that would feel a little bit derivative, right? There needs to be something a little more provocative than that this time around.
I guess the big question is if they're going to use Episode 9 to set up another trilogy. On that question, what J.J. does with Episode 9 and what he's allowed to do. Because if he's looking for some sort of like massive resolution to the whole thing, I just can't imagine they're going to wait 15 years to do another trilogy, right? Like, you'd have to assume it's going to be just a few years down the line.
Well, yeah. We already know that Rian Johnson he's already been greenlit on his new trilogy. It's just a question of whether or not it is a direct continuation or whether it's a complete...
Well, that's already been stated. Rian Johnson's new trilogy is going to have nothing to do with anything that's gone on before.
Nothing? Like, I mean, you won't even have Poe Dameron make a cameo at some point? I mean, I know they say they don't want it to be involved with the quote-unquote Star Wars or Skywalker legacy, but literally none of these characters will be involved in any way.
I mean, from what I've read, it has nothing to do with it, and it'll probably be on a totally different timeline as well. Could be hundreds of years in the past or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Which I think is cool, yeah.
But your original question was whether they will, you know, if it's not Rian Johnson, if they will continue following these new characters in a direct sequel to this sequel trilogy. That was your question, right?
Yes, yes.
After Episode 9 and just do 10, 11, 12. Yeah, that is the question. I mean, I have to presume that there will be something relatively finite in terms of J.J. bringing this thing full circle, which is one of the reasons that I like the fact that he gets to finish what he started.
Mm-hmm.
But like any, you know, like anything, like even The Dark Knight Rises still ended with a little bit of a hopeful, you know, I wouldn't call it a cliffhanger, but a suggestion of something, right? Which is a perfectly legitimate segue into talking about the end of this mm-hmm. which there's a coda, there's an epilogue tacked onto this thing. You know, obviously we haven't we haven't completely cleaned everything up, but this is a perfectly legitimate place to end. And then it's like, oh no, there's an epilogue with these fucking kids that I don't care about.
Well, again, I think that's I think that tied the whole thing together a little bit. You know, like this movie's about the fact that you don't need to be a Skywalker or of some important lineage to be, you know, force sensitive or whatever, or to be a part of the rebellion. You can just be a nobody and you know. Be a part of it, right? And I presume that will be a big theme of episode 9 is them, you know, gathering their new troops and inspiring just the normal people of the galaxy to join up and take down the First Order.
Do you think that kid is legitimately a character who we're going to check in with in the next film, you know, now that we've skipped forward 5 or 10 years or whatever, now he's grown up and is going to join the rebellion?
I don't think so.
I mean, we don't know the kid's name, right? So... Mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to give it. Yeah. Okay. It just, to me, it just felt kind of extraneous in a movie that was already pushing the time limit anyway. I felt it was unnecessary. This movie's actually 10 minutes longer than Attack of the Clones, which is the next longest mm-hmm. Star Wars film. So.
And it felt long. It did feel long.
Yeah. But just to not be a complete Debbie Downer about this whole thing, I'll just briefly mention a couple of things that I really, really loved about the experience. Porgs.
Yeah,
can't say enough good things about porgs, right?
Porgs are amazing. I mean, that piece of that one scene with Chewbacca almost eating the porg, I thought was fantastic.
I like that it still has the little pelican feet on it, even though he's barbecued yeah. it. Yeah, the porgs are great. I love the crystal foxes on the salt planet. I thought they were awesome. Mm-hmm. There's like some crazy sea monsters right off the shore of the island. Okay, just little, you know, just like little flavor, little texture. They don't mention it. They don't even really look at it. Just you can see the tail of a sea monster off in the distance. I think it's kind of fun. The two suns, Luke looking off at the two suns as he dies, I think is a mm-hmm. really lovely bookend to his journey, as it were.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
They built 125 sets for this movie. And recently George Lucas was interviewed and basically just said, yeah, that's way too many sets. Like, there's no way I would have built that many sets. Like, yes, George, we know.
We know, George.
You would have – let me guess. You would have built one set. Let me guess what color that set would have been. So anyway, he really made sure that they shot as much of this in physical environments as possible. And there's something like 200 different species of creatures introduced in this thing as well.
This movie looks great all the way through.
Hey, can you explain the golden dice to me? That's a real deep cut Star Wars nerd thing to me, and that one went over my head.
I think we only saw them in A New Hope.
But you do remember seeing them there?
No, I didn't remember. So deep cut that I didn't even remember those at all. But upon reading after the movie, that's where they're from.
That's deep, man. Like,
yeah.
I mean, then they spend a lot of time on, like, they really, the only jewelry they go deeper into in this movie is the sisters' medallions, but they really spend a lot of time with that dice, and then Luke brings them back and gives them to Leia. Like, that was, I mean, I guess that's fan service of, like, a totally new level.
A very minute percentage of people who even are Star Wars fans knew what the hell those were, so... I really am excited for you to see this movie again and let your nitpicks wash away and just enjoy the spectacle of it.
Well, here's something that I'm definitely going to look out for the next time I see it, because I caught this today in IMDb trivia. There's a typo in the opening crawl.
What?
Okay, so the opening crawl says, quote, "Only General Leia Organa's band of resistance fighters stand against the rising tyranny." Mm-hmm. Stand should be, quote-unquote, stands, as the noun band is singular. Fighters is within a prepositional phrase and does not determine the conjugation of the verb stand. So what it really should say is only General Leia Organa's band of resistance fighters stands against the rising tyranny.
Man, I did not think our nitpicks would get grammatical. Matt, I was not expecting that. That's something else.
In space, no one can hear you spell check, right?
This is a whole different galaxy, that's far, true. Far away. They have their different grammar not the rules. Same. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good place to end as any.
Well, until next time, this has been We Like Movies, talking about another Star Wars.
Happy 7th anniversary, pal. Here's to 7 more.
7 more. Let's do it. All right. See you guys.